Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. As several countries around the globe return to some sense of normalcy, the United States is seeing massive COVID surges. States like California, Florida, and Texas are reporting new daily case highs. On Saturday, Florida reported 15,300 cases. That is more than most countries in the world. At least 4,277 people have died in Florida. As of Sunday, California was averaging more than 8,000 new cases a day, more than double what it was a month ago. Yesterday, California Governor Gavin Newsom ordered all counties to close indoor restaurants and shut down bars. Hospitals are once again overwhelmed in several states. We're also learning more about airborne transmission, the proper way to wear a mask, and long-term health effects for those who recover. Without a national plan, public health officials say we could be facing months of more cases and more deaths. So given this, what are our options? Today we are joined by Jose Luis Jimenez, a chemistry professor at the University of Colorado Boulder. He specializes in atmospheric chemistry and aerosol mass spectrometry. Is that how I say that? Spectrometry?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
I don't think of
spectrometry. Thank you. Jose Luis Jimenez, thank you so much for joining us and thanks for your work.
Thanks.
We're also joined by Mark Nickus, Emeritus Professor of Environmental Health Sciences at UC Berkeley. His research involves exposure and risk assessment for microbial pathogens and chemical toxicants. He investigates the transmission of respiratory infections by exposure routes. Mark Nickus, thank you so much for joining us.
Certainly.
Well, Professor Jimenez, I just want to start off by asking you a few general questions, and then we'll get into what you really focus on. I mean, given that there is no national plan at this point, I mean, we're even hearing about PPE shortages. One of San Francisco's supervisors tweeted yesterday that it's now taking 10 days just to get a test in San Francisco because we're running out of the chemical agents. How do you explain where we are right now?
Indirectly, I shouldn't comment on this because I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm an expert on these things. I mean, I think, it's well known. We haven't done a good job at containing the virus. It's contagious, and we didn't do enough to limit the cases, and then it has transmitted too much. Yeah.
What would you add, Professor Nickus? How do you assess where we are right now?
We're in a very bad spot, and it's because there hasn't been a coordinated federal plan to control the spread of the virus, and certainly not a willingness in government to implement the kinds of measures that it would take. I mean, you know, when China implemented its lockdown in Wuhan to prevent the spread, that's the kind of lockdown that, you know, no politician in the U.S. was willing to try and implement. And it's a different culture, so I can see that that's a difficulty too. But it takes drastic measures to prevent the spread of a virus, and there's not a willingness to implement those measures.
I mean, even at the state level, you have people at the county level saying, how are we going to get out of this without one state policy? At this point, it's whack-a-mole. I mean, at this point, we've got schools up north saying we're not going to open. And then in Orange County, they're saying we're going to open with no masks and no social distancing. So again, I know that you both have specific areas where you focus, but Professor Nickus, I mean, without a national plan, how are we going to move forward and eventually get out of this? And even without state plans, because you've got one county doing one thing and another county doing something completely different.
What I think is that we're going to stumble forward, seeing the continued spread. I mean, the general incidence may go down, and then when things open up again, you'll have hot spots and they'll go up again. And that will continue until there is a, quote, herd immunity, unquote, or until you get to the point where there actually is an effective vaccine that's available. And we can only hope that would be available in early 2021. And at that point, you'd probably have an endemic virus that wasn't sort of reaping such havoc. I mean, I don't see any wonderful solution in the short term.
Right. And your thoughts on herd immunity, because I've heard some public health officials say we really don't want to go down that route. This is a huge country, and even if people don't pass, in many cases, they have long-term health problems after recovering from COVID.
That's exactly true. I mean, I'm not in favor of herd immunity as a solution to this. It's just, it may come to pass that that is a solution.
Well, and I know I'm not going to ask you both about what's going on financially and just the fact that so many people are struggling. Small businesses say we cannot keep opening and shutting. It's not going to work. And so I just want to point out and give you all an update. CNN is reporting that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she's willing to delay or scrap House lawmakers' summer break to negotiate additional economic relief for people suffering from this pandemic because the additional $600 a week is going to expire at the end of the month. And last week, we just did a show about the eviction crisis. People are already being evicted. The food lines are long. This is just a major, major economic crisis. And so I just want to acknowledge that. And we're going to definitely do a show about that. I also want to acknowledge that this is going to affect communities of color the most, people who are frontline workers. And tomorrow we are going to talk about resources that are available to people who are dealing with mental health issues, because this is really becoming just a huge crisis. People said we should not be in this at this point right now. So we're going to be covering these issues in the coming days. Let's talk about some of the new information that we are learning. Last week, the World Health Organization acknowledged that the virus can spread in the air after nearly 240 scientists sent an open letter urging the organization to update its guidance. In the letter, scientists demonstrated evidence that tiny airborne droplets pose a risk of exposure at distances beyond 6 feet from an infected individual. Professor Jimenez, you're one of the lead scientists who sent that open letter to the WHO. First off, what are we now learning about these droplets?
I think what we have been learning for a while, but the WHO has been unwilling to acknowledge, is that they play an important role in the transmission. So my personal guess is they actually are the majority of the transmission. And this has important implications, in particular for how we protect ourselves in the community against these aerosols. And what you can understand is that the droplets that WHO says dominate transmission, you know, come out of your mouth when you're talking or when you're coughing, but then they fall to the ground within a couple of meters. So if you keep away, or 6 feet, since we're in the US. So if you keep away from people by 6 feet, then you're protected. Now, the difference with aerosols is that you exhale them, and then they stay floating in the air. And if you stay enough time in a room that has low ventilation, you can build up to a level that's infective. And that's what we showed in our investigation of the Skagit Choir case in Washington State. Well, basically, that's what happened. And how you protect yourself is different, you know, because then you need to wear a mask indoor at all times instead of only if you are closer than a meter, as WHO says. And you can do things with ventilation, and you can do things with portable HEPA filters. And as you said, this is a terrible crisis, and you know, lockdowns are very difficult for people in many ways. So we should try to be smart about how to, you know, if we understand how the virus propagates, we can be much smarter about curtailing it with limiting society less.
And what is your reaction to the WHO's response? Why do you think it took them so long to acknowledge this science? Experts like yourself and others have known about this for months.
Well, they haven't really acknowledged it. They just they changed their language a little bit from saying that it was unimportant to saying it could be possibly important but very rare or something like that. They haven't really acknowledged that there is a substantial possibility that it can be major, or as I think, that is actually the dominant way. And this is a big problem. Why this happens? This has to do with the history of the medical infectious diseases field. And, you know, around 1910, there was this researcher named Chapin wrote a book And at the time, you know, germs, it wasn't a long time ago that germs had been discovered, and they were reacting against this miasma theory from the Middle Ages that bad air will give you disease. So then he emphasized that, you know, it was very, very difficult that a disease would transmit through the air. And that paradigm follows us to today. You know, the WHO asks for evidence for aerosol transmission that's much, much higher than for the other modes of transmission, for fomite and droplets. They actually have acknowledged that they don't have any direct evidence of the modes of transmission, you know, so the recommendation for hand washing and all that, although it's probably wise to do so, they don't actually have any direct evidence. And we actually have more evidence for aerosols, but they refuse to acknowledge it. So then the medical community has only accepted begrudgingly and after extensive efforts from researchers, diseases that are spectacularly transmissible through aerosols. So measles, chickenpox, tuberculosis, they are just spectacularly transmissive through aerosols, and the medical community just could not deny it that they were airborne. But anything else like COVID-19 is not like measles, is transmissible through aerosols, but much less. You need to be close to someone, or you need to be for a long time in a low ventilated space so that the virus can accumulate. So it's something in between measles and, let's say, HIV that doesn't go through the air at all. They just, that's impossible to them. And the people who dominate the WHO committee in infection control are coming from that paradigm and just totally stuck on it.
Professor Nickus, what would you add when it comes to what we now know about aerosols and spread?
Well, I have to endorse everything Dr. Jimenez says. I think he's kind of said it all. I mean, the WHO, there's an intellectual inertia, I'll call it, in updating one's understanding of the world, and the WHO is stuck in that inertia of assuming that this hand-to-face contact transmission pathway, which Dr. Jimenez referred to as fomite transmission, and this direct droplet spray pathway where you're hit by projectiles that are emitted from coughs or speaking at close distance, that these are the primary exposure mechanisms for this particular virus and for all respiratory tract pathogens. And there's certainly a logic actually behind actually eye contact leading to infection, because there is drainage from the eye into the respiratory tract. But in terms of the relative importance of those pathways, it's not demonstrated that these are of major importance for this particular infection. It's just a default assumption that the WHO proceeds with, and they don't require themselves to prove that these are important. All they're requiring proof for is that inhalation transmission is important. And part of the other limitation is that, you know, the WHO technical leaders tend to, not all, but most probably come out of epidemiology. And in epidemiology, you don't have mechanistic thinking. By mechanistic thinking, I mean that you figure out how you physically get from point A to point B. So mechanistic thinking is within the realm of the physical sciences, like engineering, whereas epidemiologists look for statistical associations between disease outcomes and possible risk factors. And just because you see a statistical association doesn't mean you understand the association physically. And so what epidemiologists want to see is really an observational study. Let me describe the cleanest observational study you could have. You have two groups of people. They're both identically exposed to the same COVID-19 patients, okay? One group wears face shields to prevent droplet spray exposure, wears gloves followed by liberal use of hand sanitizers to prevent hand-to-face contact. And the second group does the same thing, but in addition wears a respirator to prevent inhalation transmission. Now you look at the infection experience of the two groups, and if you saw that among the group who wore the respirators there was less infection incidence, you would say, well, you know, the respirators had a beneficial effect, and therefore inhalation transmission is, you know, likely at play. The problem is that these observational studies are never that clean. The subjects in the studies have a mixture of exposure control measures in use. Their use of personal protective equipment may not always be consistent, and they're never exposed to exactly the same degree to the virus, and the exposure is never quantified. So really, to call or require for such an observational study in the midst of a pandemic to prove the efficacy of respiratory protection and inhalation transmission, it's inappropriate.
Mark,
so that's
Nick
what
is...
I would add. You know, it's sort of like I'm reminded of the scene from the movie Apollo 13 where the NASA engineers are asked to very quickly make a device that will take carbon dioxide out of the air of the Apollo capsule to save the lives of the astronauts. Had that problem been given to a group of epidemiologists, we would not have seen a movie with Tom Hanks triumphantly exiting the capsule.
Mark Nickus is professor of environmental health sciences at UC Berkeley. Jose Luis Jimenez is chemistry professor at the University of Colorado Boulder. And if you have any specific questions about airborne transmission and what we know and how to protect yourself, here we are in July, and unfortunately cases are surging in many states across the country. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Professor Jimenez, unfortunately, one of the problems is that there's a lot of conflicting public health advice out there. And then, of course, not having a plan from the national government and then having a hodgepodge of policies in your area is very confusing to people. I mean, let's leave the people who just refuse to wear masks aside for a moment. What are your thoughts about all of this conflicting information?
I agree that it is a big problem. And I mean, but partially is rooted in this confusion about how the aerosol spreads, right? I mean, we've been told since the beginning you have to hand wash and you know, and the virus has been difficult to control with those measures because we were ignoring the role of aerosols. I'm convinced that's at least part of it. And then when you tell people to wear masks, but then you also tell them that the droplets are going to fall within a meter, they're like, why do I have to wear masks? I mean, in my interactions with people, I mean, I get a million questions over email or on Twitter. People are really hungry for information, and they're hungry to understand really what's going on. So, and I would say also what hasn't helped, you know, the credibility of the institutions is that the evidence has been accumulating, you know, so we've seen the information about the choir and the Guangzhou restaurants and the buses in China and all these super spreading events that really are only consistent with transmission through the air, through aerosols. But at the same time, you have the WHO denying it and saying that's not important. So, you know, that undermines confidence on those institutions. And that's, you know, so that this is, I think, one of the most important reasons why they should really acknowledge the evidence. And as Professor Nika said, you know, realize that we don't have time to do the perfect study to prove aerosol transmission. I mean, another way of saying it is because of the historical reasons I mentioned, and because of the super high bar to prove aerosol transmission, and because COVID-19 is not like measles, so it's not as spectacularly transmissive through the air, so that it cannot be denied, so that it is obvious. So the problem is for those reasons, the guidance is just being delayed.
And what would you add, Professor Nickus, especially when it comes to conflicting information?
Well, I mean, the conflicting public health messaging about the use of masks early on is a problem because I think it lingers. And I don't think that people in general have a clear understanding of what masks do. So I'm going to talk about cloth masks because that's what the public, you know, is going to be wearing and is wearing. You know, these are going to be, I'll give you ballpark figures. You could expect that a cloth mask would reduce the emission of aerosol particles carrying virus by about 75%. And you could expect that a cloth mask, when worn by a person, will reduce the inhalation of aerosol particles containing virus, should they be in the air, by about 50 to 75%. So if everyone, on a personal level, if you don't want to infect other people, wearing a cloth mask is beneficial in reducing your emission. It's not going to be perfect. The new criterion is better than nothing, and it is better than nothing. And on the personal level of protecting yourself, the cloth mask will reduce your inhalation exposure to virus by, let's say, 50 to 75%, which is not perfect, but again, it's better than nothing. So there they're beneficial on both ends. And if you had a population, everyone running around now wearing a cloth mask in public, reducing emission by 75% and reducing your inhalation exposure by, let's say, 50%, you'd have approximately 90% reduction of transmission by inhalation. Now, there's a separate issue of what's the, quote, infectious dose, how infected is the virus, and what's your level of exposure, so you really can't say that incidence is going to go down by 90%, but you would have a substantial benefit, and it would benefit you as an individual not getting infected or having your risk of infection being lower, and it would benefit the chance of you infecting other people.
Well, we have a caller on the line. Let's hear from John in Oakland. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I have been following the Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Romer on Twitter, as well as Harvard's epidemiologist Ashish Jha, and they are both very adamant that we can actually crush this virus if we implement a national program of universal testing and tracing. Paul Romer has estimated it would cost less than 3 weeks of what we are losing economically because of the lockdowns and the basic closing of the whole economy. And yet there doesn't seem to be any leadership, not only in the government, but I mean among other academics. And I mean, I haven't heard anything about universal testing or tracing. I just think this is all of their listeners should, I think, bear in mind that if it would work, we should try it. And if it does work, we could literally crush this virus into a manageable, infinitesimal thing with universal testing and tracing.
Well, thank you for that. I just looked up Supervisor Matt Haney in San Francisco. As of yesterday, he said it takes 10 days now to get a COVID appointment. Now, I know someone 3 weeks ago who got a next day appointment, and it took him 3 days to get his results. Supervisor Haney is now tweeting just as an hour ago, 15 to 20 days to get a COVID appointment to get tested in San Francisco, even if you are an essential worker. I mean, Professor Jimenez, I'm kind of at a loss for words, because if you think you have the virus and it's going to take you that long just to get an appointment in a city like San Francisco...
What can I say? I mean, this is the lack of testing and the lack of contact tracing is, I'm at a loss for words as well. I mean, yesterday I was talking with someone who works at the WHO, and what he said is that, you know, much poorer countries than the U.S. have been successful with contact tracing, and they've managed but they've made it a national priority. Right. To enact contact tracing, and they have been able to stamp down the virus thanks to these efforts. I mean, like someone said on Twitter at some point, you know, are we a third world country just with lipstick on? Because it's really the behavior of this government is just not consistent with the advanced intellectual, technical, industrial powerhouse that the U.S. is.
What would you add, Professor Nickus? I mean, in a city like San Francisco, Matt Haney, the supervisor, said he spoke to the Department of Public Health. They said that they're completely overwhelmed with demand. We need all hands on deck. We need support from the state and the feds.
Yes, they do. We all do. And it shows the complete failure. I'll put it on Trump. Well, it shows the complete failure of the Trump administration have a federal policy and a federal program that actually makes things available in a timely fashion and in a consistent fashion to all states. And to leave it to individual states and individual localities to basically collect all the apparatus and all the reagents and all the testing facilities is just anarchy. You know, I mean, it's just not the way to fight a war, and this is kind of a public health war. You know what the analogy would be? If you were organizing the invasion of D-Day and you had five beaches you were going to invade, you would tell each person in charge of a beach, well, you know, collect what you need for yourself. You know, go out and get it and just be ready to go forward, you know, without any organization and coordination. It's ridiculous. I do want to comment on the issue of can we contact trace and test, and wouldn't this be good? I mean, I'm all for testing and contact tracing, but my impression is that we're at such a level of spread now that it becomes impractical to try and do all this contact tracing. I mean, forget about the delay in testing. To try, you know, in Florida, you have 15,000 cases a day, or at least, and that was a high point. How are you going to feasibly contact trace all those 15,000 cases? I mean, there's not enough people. There's not enough time to do it. I think that contact tracing would be very effective at the start of an epidemic when there's not a great abundance of cases where you can actually locate people in a timely fashion and have them quarantined. I kind of think we're beyond that point in a lot of cases, in a lot of places.
Well, Professor Jimenez, I know we have to let you go. I just want to ask you one more question about aerosols lingering in the air indoors. You've studied some of the super spreader outbreaks this year in places of worship, which you say had to be from airborne transmission. There was a choir event in Washington State earlier this year. 52 people got infected. Just briefly, what can you tell us about how long these aerosols linger in the air indoors?
We don't know very well because we have limited information, but we think, you know, an hour or two would be a reasonable estimate, you know. So definitely they can accumulate, like what happened in the choir. They were singing. Singing is an activity that leads to a lot of aerosol exhalation. And then that room wasn't very well ventilated, so the infective aerosols build up over time. And everyone else was breathing deeply, so was inhaling a lot of these aerosols. So that's how the case can be explained. You know, something about those cases is you have now the WHO and some of the people on kind of that camp, if we call it that way, who are engaging on denial. You know, they are saying on their official guidance that the case can be explained by fomites and droplets. So this means there is droplets coming out of this person who was singing, who are landing on 53 other people, or they touch 53 people, touch the same surface. And now there were two 10-minute breaks, and CDC is saying you need 15 minutes talking to someone face-to-face. So, you know, the index case could have infected a few people by those pathways. So I think at this point, I'm putting that kind of response at the same level as the climate deniers. This is just not scientific. And it has to stop. I mean, when you have a major international organization that's really dismissing evidence with no basis and is putting out guidance that violates the laws of physics, what they say about particle sizes is just totally wrong. I mean, it just doesn't give confidence that they have their act together to control the pandemic.
Well, Professor Jimenez, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your work.
Thanks.
Jose Luis Jimenez is a chemistry professor at the University of Colorado Boulder. He specializes in atmospheric chemistry. He's one of the lead scientists who sent that open letter to the World Health Organization. Sticking with us for the rest of the hour is Mark Nickus, professor of environmental health sciences at UC Berkeley. His research involves exposure and risk assessment for microbial pathogens and chemical toxicants. Today, we are talking about the COVID-19 surges in the United States and what it will take to get a handle on this with no national plan. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the effectiveness of wearing a mask and the proper way to wear a mask. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Excuse me. Tomorrow, we are going to discuss the pandemic's mental health toll. More than 30% of adults in the United States report symptoms of anxiety or depression. So we will talk about resources like teletherapy, free counseling for frontline workers, and the crisis text line. And if you are in need of any resources, we do have a resource page at kalw.org. There are a number of resources there, and I hope you can join us for tomorrow's show. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall at kalw.org. Our phone lines are full right now, but you can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Today, we're joined by Mark Nickus, professor of environmental health sciences at UC Berkeley. And now I would like to welcome Rachel Jones to the show. Rachel is associate professor at the University of Utah. Her research focuses on the health of workers and communities, infectious agents, and the prevention of exposure. Hi, Professor Jones. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking about surges in San Francisco. It's now taking up to 15 days to get an appointment for a test. Professor Jones, I just wonder, how do you assess where we are right now?
Well, I think we're struggling, and it sounds like San Francisco is particularly struggling if one can't get access to tests. Here in Utah, that it doesn't seem to be an issue to date, but there is a big tension in terms of people wanting to return to a normal life, some form of normalcy, despite the continued surge of cases and the risk that that poses to people who may be intolerant of that risk and want to continue to minimize the potential that they acquire COVID-19.
And we're learning just so much as we go. I recently heard one CDC estimate that 40% of people infected with COVID are asymptomatic. This is just so important to spread this information, because you might not have symptoms and you might have COVID and you might be spreading it. Can you say anything about that, Professor Jones?
Yeah, I mean, the asymptomatic spreading of the disease is one of the unique features that makes it particularly difficult to attempt to control, because well-meaning people don't understand or don't know that they're sick, and that's a legitimate response to being asymptomatic. And then if they don't observe social distancing and other precautions, then unwittingly they're able to spread the disease. And that's why it's important to remain vigilant in terms of social distancing, whether or not you have symptoms at the time.
Right. And Professor Nickus, the chance of transmission from people with no symptoms is 75%, according to the CDC.
I really don't understand what that statistic means, the chance of transmission being 75%. So, yes, if you're asymptomatic or you're infectious, yes, you certainly have a chance of transmitting to other people. I don't know whether they're saying that 75% of all infections, of all cases, are due to infections by people who are asymptomatic. If that's what they're saying, that's kind of surprising, but maybe not, because you would probably be more prone to be around someone who you didn't think was sick than who was sick, and so I could see them contributing more of the infections, if that's what the CDC means.
Well, let's talk about the importance of wearing masks. According to the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation, if 95% of people wear masks in the United States in public, we could save 33,000 more people from dying before October. Professor Jones, can you talk about the importance of wearing a mask and the type of mask for the public, not for health workers, that is most effective?
Right. So the variety of masks are available for sale for the general public or can be made at home. And the performance of those masks in terms of preventing people who are sick from shedding the virus and protecting people from who maybe have the potential to inhale the virus is really highly variable. And the variability comes both from the material that the mask is made of, as well as the quality of the fit of the mask. And studies about the performance of the mask generally find that masks that have a tightly woven fabric or multiple layers of tightly woven fabric tend to offer better filtration than more loosely woven fabrics. So for this, you'd be looking for something that is very tight and has a lot of threads per inch. And so that would be the better mask material if you're making your own mask. If you're buying a commercial mask, some of those materials are fabric, some are what are might be called, have layers of what are called meltdown polyester fibers. That's the material that's in surgical masks as well. and some of them have electrostatic charging. And the challenge with the mask is that there's no standard testing for any of these devices. And so it's really hard as a consumer to evaluate the quality and the performance that you can expect from the device. And now the issue of fit has to do with the fact that if the mask doesn't fit snugly to your face, air can go around the mask carrying a virus particles that haven't passed through the fabric. And that's an important factor, particularly is well known in the context of respirators, but it's also an issue in general for masks. So the best masks would have tightly woven materials that fit closely and snugly to the face. But again, it's hard to predict how well those masks will perform for any particular individual or individual mask.
Well, we have a caller who has a question about masks. Let's go to Helene in Oakland. Hi, Helene.
Good morning. Thanks so much for discussing this. I see more and more masks being sold online now that tout their breathability because they have a respirator. These are not considered medical. They're not what a doctor might wear or a nurse. But my understanding is those valves that make them breathable also provide absolutely no protection to anyone around that person because the valves are one way. And I saw a comment from Dr. Atul Gawande saying that these masks are evil and should be banned because they provide false security, both for the, well, specifically for the people who are around an individual with that type of mask. So I just would like your comment on that.
Professor Nickus, do you want to take that first?
Sure. Right. When you have an exhalation valve, which I think is the valve that you're talking about, it is true that some air will escape the mask. Some of the exhaled air will escape the mask out of the exhalation valve. The issue becomes how much more air will escape out of the exhalation valve than is already escaping unfiltered from around the perimeter of the face piece. So as Dr. Jones was saying, you know, when you have a mask that's on your face, and especially cloth masks that generally do not fit snugly on the face, you know, you have these ear loop kind of masks, and an ear loop mask tends not to make a tight, snug fit on the face. You have a substantial amount of air that can, when you exhale, a substantial amount of unfiltered air is going to come out around the edges. And so, you know, that's why these are not perfect emission reduction devices. The exhalation valve will allow some more air to come out because instead of, you know, the air that's being directed right into the filter, out through the filter, some of it will now go out the exhalation valve. The issue becomes how much more? I mean, how much worse is the exhalation valve on the mask than not having an exhalation valve? And to my knowledge, no one has ever looked at that, even for approved respirators, where you have respirators with exhalation valves and without, no one has quantitatively studied that. A paper I've seen made the observation that, well, you know, we didn't see the valve, this was for respirators with exhalation valves, we didn't see the valve being activated, and maybe it's only when someone is doing a moderate level of work would the sort of force of the air being exhaled be enough to actually activate the exhalation valve and cause air to come out. So my conclusion is this. It would be better than not to not have a respirator with an exhalation valve, but I don't think it's a game changer.
What would you add, Professor Jones?
I would agree with Dr. Nickus's comments that, you know, there are multiple processes by which the air may exit the mask without being filtered. And I think one thing that causes people concern about the exhalation valve in my conversations is they feel that it might be coming out with force in a particular direction, and that often the exhalation valves are on the front, and so it may seem like it creates a jet. But it's really, we don't have a lot of data yet to date about how many particles might be coming out through the valve. The other thing about the valve is that it's not just an opening. There is actually a rubber gasket or other device inside that causes the air to flow in a circuitous path. And anytime the air has to change direction, such as passing through a valve, is an opportunity for particles to be deposited inside the valve and therefore to not make it out. So I would agree that I don't think that if you have a mask that doesn't have an exhalation valve, you should continue to wear it, but that people who do wear a mask with an exhalation valve are not likely contributing substantially more to disease risk than people who are wearing cloth or other kinds of masks.
Yeah, I was just going to say the masks that I'm seeing are cloth. They do, most of the masks I see cover the nose, top of the nose to the bottom of the chin. And I'm seeing so many more ads for these kinds of masks online. So it's basically a piece of fabric that you would use for clothing. It seems like the majority of people, at least what I'm seeing, are wearing those. What about those, Professor Jones?
Yeah, so those are the same issues in that the better filtration performance has a tighter woven cotton fabric than a looser woven fabric. And, you know, the challenge is that the tighter the fabric weave and the more layers of fabric you have, the harder it is for the air to flow through the fabric, too. And more air is then released out the sides and around the nose of the mask. So the cloth masks tend not to be very tight-fitting. And again, the filtration performance of the fabric is really highly variable.
It seems like there's so much confusion. And now that there's so many masks being sold online, Gail writes, most of these masks sold online are thin and flimsy. How do you find an effective mask? I mean, again, here we are in July, Professor Jones. We started talking about masks in March. At that time, you know, a lot of scientists who came on our show said, no, they're not effective. And then, yes, they are effective. But it seems like there needs to be PSAs out there to let people know what is effective. Do you know of any organization or group that has put together a website where people can go to learn more about what is effective and what isn't?
I haven't seen anything available yet. I mean, there's a group called N95 Decon that has been putting together a lot of informational materials about first how to decontaminate filtering face piece respirators and other kinds of materials without destroying them for healthcare worker. But I know they're currently working on a document that summarizes literature about what we know about the performance of cloth masks. And I believe that should be available in a couple of weeks. That is still under development in that group. But I haven't seen any other kind of systematic consolidation of the emerging studies around mask performance. Although, you know, I would imagine that there are dozens of laboratories across the United States currently testing all of these devices, and new papers continue to be published.
Right. And then there's a study in the scientific journal Physics of Fluids that found bandanas are not effective. And what's happening in some cases is if you go to a store and you don't have a mask, some people are grabbing a bandana and just putting that around their faces.
Right. Yeah. And there was also a study a number of years ago by investigators at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health looking at the performance of things like bandanas and T-shirts that one might wear in the case of a disaster. And they also found that those kinds of devices offered very little, those kinds of fabrics offered very little filtration performance. And I think that study was very influential in terms of at least my thinking, and I think others' thinking, that these kind of homemade masks are not likely to be very effective. And there's been some further studies that have come out recently that show, again, it's just highly variable, the filtration efficiency. And there remains a gap in knowledge about how much material then bypasses and just exits the mask without passing through the filters.
We have a question from Leslie. If face coverings are worn at, say, a 90% compliance rate under the circumstances specified, how long would doing so be effective in sufficiently lowering, if not eliminating, the virus, at least in the Bay Area? Or would the lack of compliance in neighboring counties effectively erase the gains? We don't live in a bubble after all. Professor Nickus, what are your thoughts on that?
That requires more than a back-of-the-envelope calculation. I think that if you had 90% compliance, okay, that you would reduce people wearing, some kind of effective mask to reduce emission and then also reduce inhalation. I think you would have a beneficial effect on reducing the incidence of infection. But the problem is that infection would still be occurring. And so I could see that initially you would have a drop in cases, okay, because you were successful in reducing emission, but you would still have cases running around who might be asymptomatic, and you'll still have ongoing transmission. And now it may forever be decreasing, okay, but then, you know, at some point, that maybe when it decreases a lot, people will say, well, the problem's solved, and masks will stop being used, and now you'll have the virus emerging again, just like we had with the opening of the economy. There's a lot of factors that go into making a prediction about what will happen in the future, and I don't have a crystal ball.
Professor Jones, are you still with us, or did you drop?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay, good. I just heard a click. What would you add?
I agree with Dr. Nickus on that. I think it's difficult to know what the future will be, but certainly increased compliance with masks will have a benefit in reducing transmission. But at this point, I can't say without a lot of analysis about how quickly that would occur and kind of to what extent. So I would agree with Dr. Nickus that it's hard to predict the future, but it seems that this is going to be something that's an ongoing problem for months to come.
All right. Well, thank you for that question. We have another question from Leslie. How effective are paper surgical masks? Professor Jones?
So surgical masks, they look like paper, but generally they are they include three or four layers of different material. There's an external layer that looks pretty paperish that has some water resistance properties. And then inside is what's called a melt-blown polyester layer, and that offers some filtration efficiency. And then inside is usually another layer that is more for comfort of the wearer. So like it's softer on the skin than the polyester. And so those masks are subject to some testing of filtration efficiency, and they have to meet some specific criteria for that in terms of capturing 95% of this certain bacteria that is passed through the filter material. But again, those masks don't fit tightly to the face, and so there's a lot of opportunity for virus in the air to move around the mask when people inhale or exhale. And so there have been quite a bit of studies about how well surgical masks protect people. And again, they are variable, but they do show better performance than many cloth masks when tested. And I believe you see studies show about 50% reduction in exposures.
Does the color of a mask make a difference, especially when you're out in the sun?
I don't think that the color makes a difference. I think that the surgical masks sometimes come in different colors, which is more about like branding and distinguishing the different types of masks within an institution. So some are blue, some are red, some are white. Did that answer your question?
Yes. No, thank you. No, thank you. And we're almost out of time, but, you know, given where we are right now, Professor Nickus, 20 states have masks. Masks are mandatory in 20 states, not in Florida or Arizona. Given that, and given that this virus is really going off in Florida and Arizona, I mean, you've got mayors saying, you know, please, governor, implement a mask requirement. But as of right now, they're not doing it.
Well, it's a bad choice. I mean, I think that it's probably the simplest thing that can be done at the moment. You know, it's simpler than testing and contact tracing. Not that those are bad, but the simplest thing that could be done immediately is for everyone to wear a mask out in the public. And again, they're not perfect, but they'll do something better. They're, quote, better than nothing, unquote. And it's something that can readily be done. I don't think there's a shortage of cloth masks in the world. There's a shortage of N95 respirators and all sorts of other personal protective equipment needed by healthcare workers. But I don't think the shortage extends to cloth masks. So I think that's something could be immediately done. And if governors and mayors in those states said, yes, we're going to require this, then that would be good. And the public health messaging that would go along with it is to encourage people. Now, there are going to be the minority of people who feel that their individual liberty demands that they be allowed to run around as they want. And so I don't know how you would enforce that. But the fact is that at least if you have the majority of people wearing cloth masks, then that would be of a great benefit. And so I think that the governors of Florida and Arizona should get off their duffs and do something positive.
Professor Jones, just quickly, I just want to make sure we get Cindy's question in. For people who have breathing problems, do you have any recommendations for a mask?
Not specifically. I mean, I think it's a little bit probably for a trial and error for those individuals to try to find a face covering that offers some filtration, but that does not aggravate their breathing condition. And so certainly there would be masks that would be more and or less comfortable for a person with a breathing condition. And an individual with that condition should, of course, not wear a mask that aggravates that. And so I would just simply recommend some trial and error with a couple of cloth mask options to find one that they feel comfortable in, knowing also that for everyone, wearing a cloth mask that has tightly woven fabric while exercising or whatever, it's not comfortable. And so, you know, you need to be conscious of your own health concerns and limitations and not exacerbate an asthma or other pulmonary condition or heart condition by wearing a mask that makes it difficult to breathe.
All right. Well, thank you for that question, Cindy. Rachel Jones is associate professor at the University of Utah. Professor Jones, thank you for your work and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Mark Nickus is professor of environmental health sciences at UC Berkeley. Professor Nickus, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Certainly.
Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio running. And I hope you can join us for tomorrow's show. We're going to talk about COVID's mental health toll. More than 30% of adults report symptoms of anxiety or depression. We will be sharing resources. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.